This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. In this half hour, I'll be reading articles of interest from magazines like Hobby Farms and Mother Earth News that may help us to live a little bit more naturally. Today's articles will focus primarily on the spring growing season. I'll get started with Self-Reliance Magazine, Spring 2024, issue number 32. This first article is called Spring Foraging by Randall Bonner. Now that spring is here and the days are getting longer, enjoying the outdoors becomes a little more accessible. With the budding new growth and greenery, foraging opportunities abound. While the quest for wild foods mostly takes place in wild places, the landscapes of civilization lend themselves to multiple habitats that support a wide variety of unique wild edibles. Taking a walk on a sunny day along the shorelines of riparian habitats will open your eyes, mind, and palate to many of these plants growing all around us that we simply take for granted. Stinging nettles. Late winter downpours encourage lots of green growth. Stinging nettles are the first to show themselves in the spring as their tender shoots begin to rise from the ground. These plants tend to get a bad rap. However, with a few precautions, they provide a foraging opportunity that is easy to collect a sustainable bounty. Early spring is the best time to pick them, as the leaves are very tender and full of flavor. If you trim the top, the rest of the plant will bush back out. Though mostly known for their negative attributes, nettles are underrated. Cooked nettles resemble sweet spinach in flavor when prepared properly. Wild harvesting nettles takes a little care to conduct without stinging yourself. To harvest them efficiently and effectively, you'll need a good pair of solid constructed gloves, made with something like thick latex rubber or leather, a pair of long scissors, and a container they will not be able to sting through. Hold the container below the plant and trim the leaves so they fall in. Keeping the leaves in a paper bag in the fridge will help keep them fresh for when you're ready to cook. You can also dry them to use a later date. When you're ready to bring the nettles into the kitchen, put some olive oil or butter in a pan along with enough water to cover the bottom. Sauté the greens. The resulting steam will wilt the trichomes, the part that does the stinging. You can then use them in just about any dish you would normally add sautéed greens. Other culinary uses for the plant include tea, soup, pesto, and even flavoring beer. Nettles are high in calcium, vitamin A, vitamin C, iron, manganese, and potassium, much like spinach and other leafy greens. Black cottonwood buds. Many of the same riparian areas where nettles grow are prime habitats for black cottonwood trees that tower over the edges of agricultural fields. As new growths bud out from their limbs, the buds contain a resinous compound with anti-inflammatory properties used to treat congestion, skin irritation, aches, and pains through wildcrafting a poplar salve called Balm of Gilead. To forage sustainably, look for downed trees or branches or simply be mindful of how much you gather. As a general rule for foraging, pick from many trees, not just one. Never pick the terminal buds, but only from the sides of the branches, and don't return to the same trees the next year. Morel mushrooms. In the same riparian habitats, you may find what are commonly referred to as early morels. Verpa bohemica. These mushrooms are also called thimble caps because the caps sit on top of the stipe rather than creating a hollow form from top to bottom like morels. A cross-section of these mushrooms will reveal these qualities as well as the cotton-like core. Verpa bohemica is commonly found under cottonwood trees. Morchella americana, a morel mushroom that will seasonally follow the fruiting of Verpa bohemica, extends the opportunities for spring foraging. Begin to look for both species when the highs and lows in the forecast average out to between 50 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Once the seeds begin to fall from cottonwood trees, it's likely that you've missed the boat for these. Violets. Purple and white violets are quite common in the woody undergrowth of riparian areas. Each flower has its own unique flavor, from the nutty, earthy white violet to the sweet purple violet. They carry a bouquet of signature tastes that complement salads, desserts, and the like. As a general rule of sustainability, never pick the first one you see because it may be the last one in that patch. Only pick one or two for every 10 or 20 blooms. In all my wilderness adventures through the mountains, valley, and coast, there's a certain comfort to coming home to my own backyard and familiar surroundings. If you find yourself stuck at home, there's a few common plants that exist in most any front lawn or backyard that isn't treated with chemicals. And if you live in an apartment, you can probably still find any of these in the local parks. Dead nettle. Dead nettle is one plant in particular that is very abundant, easy to harvest, and easy to find. It's in virtually every city park and residential lawn. Unlike stinging nettle, it lacks the properties which create skin irritation and has a soft, velvety texture. Medicinal and nutritional properties of dead nettle are antifungal, anti-inflammatory, and antibacterial, as well as including high concentrations of iron, fiber, and antioxidants like vitamin C. You can find it nearly anywhere, but as a general rule for everything on this list, avoid foraging anything that's within social distance of the roads. This green has a variety of applications, but if you have enough of it, dead nettle is best suited for making pesto. And let's be honest, pesto is really only a combination of nuts, olive oil, and Parmesan cheese that are all just a vehicle to transfer a small dose of greens into our diet. If you eat a lot of pasta, it's worth a shot to try. It can also be dried for making tea, or in salads and stir fry. Due to its texture, it's best to use it to accent a salad rather than to make a salad out of dead nettle alone. Dandelions. Dandelions seem to be the focus for weed killer advertising, but they've got a number of uses other than being the poster child of unwanted weeds. The flowers are edible, and their petals make an incredible dandelion jelly that tastes like honey lemon gelatin. The leaves are high in antioxidants, iron, magnesium, calcium, and potassium. They can make a great standalone salad. You can also chop them to create a slaw or sauté them like any other wilted greens. The roots can be dried and ground into a powder to make tea or eaten raw. They contain a carbohydrate called inulin, a soluble fiber that supports the growth and maintenance of a healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Broadleaf plantain. Plantain has some pretty unique medicinal qualities on top of its value as a wild edible. It helps stop bleeding, supports tissue regeneration, and performs as a natural antiseptic. Great for scrapes, bug bites, or bee stings, it's like an ointment that grows in your backyard. You can create a healing balm from oils of the plant or simply chew the leaves raw and apply directly to the skin. It helps to have a bandage just to keep it in place. It will also aid in bringing a splinter to the surface of the skin. This weed adds some biodiversity to gardens that don't spray. They've even seemed to evolve into a flat growth pattern that is elusive to lawnmowers. Forage forth. Now that you've got some backyard travel ideas, you can start planning your foraging day, trip, or weekend campout. All of these wild edibles can be found in most city parks and lawns, although they should be foraged sustainably and with caution. Check for areas which may be sprayed with pesticides, herbicides, or other pollutants. Don't consume anything without first studying each species thoroughly and making informed decisions. A local expert's advice or a field guide specific to your area are generally the most reliable resources. Most importantly, Simply observing these species, along with many others that share the same space, is entertaining and educational, whether or not you choose to bring any of them home. Taking a stroll through the park and shopping for wild foods in the sunshine can be a nice change of pace from pushing a cart through the aisles of the grocery store and picking up a few items to take to the checkout line. It's a good opportunity to enjoy the day and go outside, rain or shine. I'm going to stick with the same publication and kind of the same theme. The next article is called Wild Onions. It's by James Turnbow. Spring has always been recognized as a time of renewal and change. Cool mornings and warm days bring flowers to bloom. Crappie and bass fish start to spawn. And it is the beginning of foraging season for many. But between the morel mushrooms and antler sheds, there is another prize to be found. Wild onions. I grew up in the oak-filled forests of what is now recognized as the reservation for the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma. The banks of the North and South Canadian rivers marked the borders where my dad and uncles taught me to hunt for the springtime treat. The Seminole, Muscogee, and many other tribal nations have a deep appreciation for this traditional delicacy. When spring arrives, so do the wild onions, and with them a renewed hope and strength to survive. Many of the elders I grew up with taught me that during spring, it is important to reflect and eat your fill of onions so that you can stay healthy. Wild onions are a delicious and nutritious food source that grow almost everywhere in North America, especially the central and southern parts of the United States. So how do you find them? Onions will generally grow in areas with a moderate amount of shade and water. A good place to find them sprouting is under hardwood trees in the undergrowth. Wild onions smell a lot like domestic onions, so your nose can also be a useful tool. I'm sure you've been outside during spring and felt the pungent odor of an onion fill your nostrils while someone was mowing their grass. There is a good chance they had a small onion patch on their lawn and hit it with their mower. Onions are not hard to find. And once you've located one, you'll often find yourself in an entire patch. An onion patch can carpet an entire area of woodland. Ditches or drainage areas are also a good place to look, even in town. Some of the best onions I've had were found in the ditches of streets. Just watch for cars if you go that route. Onion discoveries will vary year to year, depending on the weather, but I usually start looking in late February to early March. Once you locate a patch, you can keep an eye on the onions and dig them up when they're ready. I usually harvest plants that are 6 to 12 inches in length. If you dig them up too soon, it will take more onions to make a meal, but if you wait too long, they will be tough. Once an onion starts to seed out, you want to avoid it. A skilled chef can work with a seeded onion, but I am generally leery of them. The seed stems will form in the interior of the plant, and you will often find it when cleaning your onions. I was always told by my elders to never take more than a third of an onion patch. By leaving onions behind, you ensure the next person that stumbles upon the patch will have onions to feed their family. It also guarantees that you can find onions in the same spot next year. I only have 3 patches that I harvest from now because the yield is so good every year. A shovel is fine to dig up the onions, but I prefer to wait until after a heavy rain when you can just pull the plants up. If I am going to actually be digging, a potato fork is my tool of choice. If you are foraging on public property, be sure to fill any holes back in. Another thing to be aware of is crow poison and wild garlic. Here in Oklahoma, crow poison and wild garlic look similar to our wild onions, but there are some differences. The top leaves of wild onions will always be bladed like grass. The leaves of wild garlic will always be hollow, almost like a tube or a shoot. Crow poison has leaves that are bladed similar to wild onions, but does not have an odor like onions or garlic do. Crow poison is toxic and should not be eaten. Wild garlic is not poisonous, and I have known some folks that eat it. Cleaning onions isn't hard, it just takes time. The cleaning process is best done outside, but a kitchen sink will suffice. You want to start by removing all of the dead and yellowed leaves from the plant. You can use your fingers to pull off the dead portions. The next step is to cut the bulb of the plant where the fingers of the root are. Lots of folks use a knife for this, but it can be done with your fingernails by just pinching it off. Then wash the onions. It's important to get all the mud and dirt off the plant. Pay special attention to the folds of the leaves, as dirt and debris can often get stuck there. Once you have a stack of cleaned onions, you're ready to store or cook them. In either case, you'll want to take the onions and set them in a large strainer. With water gently running, take a handful of the onions and cut them into sections 1 to 2 inches long with a pair of kitchen scissors. A knife can be used for this step, but I have found scissors work best. Continue this process until all the onions are cut up. Work the strainer to make sure no dirt or debris remains, and then package the onions into freezer bags. I have stored onions this way for up to a year with no problems. When it comes time to cook onions, the Seminole people enjoy wild onions with eggs and a helping of salt meat. There are a couple of ways to cook wild onions, but my favorite recipe is below. Place a half gallon of onions into a skillet and heat them with about 2 tablespoons of bacon grease until they are tender and wilted. You want to keep the onions on a low heat and stir them occasionally. You are not frying them, just cooking them down. Once the onions have been sufficiently cooked, add in 3 to 6 eggs. You can pre-beat the eggs or just stir as they are added in. Add salt and pepper to taste. If you do not have any grease on hand, the onions can be cooked down in water. This recipe makes about 4 servings. I strongly believe that the food nature provides us naturally is always the best. For my people, picking wild onions and eating them is a time for fellowship and community building. I hope this guide helps you to pursue both this spring. Until we meet again. James Turnbow is a citizen of the Seminole Nation and lifelong resident of Oklahoma. He belongs to the Snake Clan and grew up in Konawha, Oklahoma, where his father and uncles taught him to live with the land and harvest the bounties of nature. From a young age, he learned how to forage, hunt, and fish to provide food using the traditional techniques of the Seminole people. Editor's note: crow poison is a catch-all term which can apply to a variety of toxic plants that resemble wild onions but should not be eaten. Among them is Star of Bethlehem, which is moderately toxic, and Death Camas, which are highly poisonous. We believe that the author's use of crow poison refers to Star of Bethlehem because that species does not have an onion scent like the author describes. If you are unsure of the plant you harvest, contact your local agriculture extension office or a trusted foraging expert to verify if it's edible. Let's switch publications and look at a little bit of Mother Earth news. This is the February-March 2024 issue of that magazine, and I'd like to do some Green Gazette. This is by Darby Stipe. States manage deer populations. Chronic wasting disease, CWD, is a fatal illness that eats away at the brains of deer, elk, and moose. Since 2000, CWD has been found in Midwest and Great Plains deer populations and could be spreading across states. In a Kansas City University Radio, KCUR report, Kristen Schuler, a wildlife disease ecologist at Cornell University, said the disease kills brain cells by creating a plaque on the brain, leaving holes in its wake. After becoming infected, a deer may not develop any symptoms for more than a year, but when it does, the deer may act strangely or appear to be sick. While the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention states there have been no reports of humans contracting the disease, it is recommended not eating any meat from animals that have been infected. This past year, Oklahoma has verified its first positive case in the state. Matt Gamble, senior manager of wildlife conservation for the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, told KCUR the tribe is looking to prevent its further spread by utilizing a grant from the federal government that would allow it to expand testing and establish a protocol to follow if the disease is detected on the reservation. Gamble added that healthy deer populations are essential for the cultural practices of the tribe, which include tanning hides, as well as for the tourism in the area. For more information on CWD, visit cdc.gov/prions/cwd/index.html. To learn about testing for CWD in deer, contact your state wildlife agency. Food for thought. Big plans for America's biggest edible fruit. The pawpaw is a tree native to North America, known for its large fruit that tastes like a cross between banana and mango. With a short shelf life and easily damaged skins, the pawpaw fruit isn't common in grocery stores, even during its limited season. Project Pawpaw has been using research and traditional plant breeding techniques to make the pawpaw fruit a more viable crop for farmers to grow in a perennial system and to bring them to market. Focusing on native perennials, such as the pawpaw fruit, provides a low-input, high-value crop for farmers, contributing to both stability and resiliency for them, as well as increasing diversity for local ecosystems. To breed these trees, Project Pawpaw breeders choose parent plants based on desirable traits, such as fruit quality and plant vigor, and then pollinate them with a paintbrush. After the pollinated seeds emerge from the fruit, they're stored over winter and then grown for 2 years in a greenhouse before being planted in the field. Project Pawpaw is entirely crowdfunded, and with the funds raised in a recent campaign, the team plans to establish the first Project Pawpaw breeding orchard in spring 2024. Get updates about the project at www.projectpawpaw.com. Palmology on paper. Filmmaker Sebastian Coe released a short film in October 2023 about the U.S. Department of Agriculture's pomological watercolor collection. Prior to modern methods of documenting plants, fruits and nut sellers needed a way to reliably identify and protect their cultivars. In 1886, the USDA commissioned illustrators to capture newly created varieties of fruits and nuts around the country, ensuring they recreated the shapes, colors, and textures for each. By 1942, more than 7,500 illustrations had been completed by approximately 21 illustrators. The images were finally released to the public in 2019, showcasing the remarkable diversity of fruit varieties, as well as the intricate details of the botanical illustrations. View the whole video about the collection titled Pomological on AEON.co by searching for Sebastian K.O. You can also explore the entire digitized collection by searching for USDA Pomological Watercolors at www.nal.usda.gov. Contribute to a homegrown national park. The homegrown national park movement is offering a call to property owners and land managers across the U.S. to establish native plants while removing invasive ones to provide more wildlife-friendly habitats. According to the movement's website, this project is the largest cooperative conservation project ever conceived or attempted. The initial goal is to develop 20 million acres of native plantings, which represents the space used by about half of the privately owned green lawns in the U.S. With small efforts by many people, the homegrown national park movement hopes to augment existing ecological networks and increase native plant and animal populations so they're better able to withstand changes. With only about 2% to 3% of Earth's land areas remaining ecologically intact, according to a 2021 Frontiers study, bolstering local ecosystems and biodiversity adds an urgent relevancy to the project. For more information about how to contribute, explore resources, donate, and plant in your area, visit www.homegrownnationalpark.org. Notably, you can check out a constantly updated map of the U.S. and Canada that shows the acreage per state or province of native plantings established so far. Students push for climate change preparedness. High schoolers at more than 50 schools across the U.S. have launched a campaign that would require school districts to plan for climate disasters and add climate education to the curriculum. Organized by the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led organization dedicated to stopping climate change, the Green New Deal for Schools campaign aims to use petitions to school boards, walkouts, and teach-ins to affect change, calling for transitioning school infrastructure to 100% renewable energy sources, providing students with locally sourced free lunches, getting administrations to create extreme weather disaster plans, and more. According to the Sunrise Movement, students want educators and scientists to develop a comprehensive climate justice curriculum to be taught in schools. The Green New Deal for Public Schools Act, a bill championed by the Sunrise Movement, was introduced in Congress by Senator Ed Markey and Representative Jamal Bowman. 77 representatives have co-sponsored the bill so far. Other notable proposals in the bill include providing grants to turn existing public school facilities into zero-carbon schools and establishing a program to increase the resiliency of the public school system during climate change-related events or public health crises. Learn more about the bill and the Sunrise Movement's campaign at www.sunrisemovement.org. We just have a couple minutes left, so let's turn to some country lore from the same Mother Earth News publication, which is readers' advice to live by, basically. Magpies vamoose. Magpies are wonderful protectors of small birds when cats are on the prowl, but just like all of us, they get hungry, and chicken eggs are a favorite meal. A magpie will peck a tiny hole in the eggshell and then eat the contents. I've tried a lot of things to keep magpies out of my chicken coop, but this has been the most effective. I tacked some heavy-gauge plastic sheeting over the coop entrance and then cut slits to form slats about 4 to 6 inches apart. Picture a commercial plastic strip curtain door for a cooler, only on a much smaller scale. My hens can go in and out of the door easily, but the magpies are deterred. That was submitted by Mary Martin of Rexburg, Idaho. Space-saving brooder. When adding a few more ducklings and goslings to my flock last spring, I needed a suitable brooder but didn't want to spend a lot of money on one. I had some unused 1x5-foot shelving boards handy and bought 8 corner brackets, braces, and 4 flat mending plates. I made the box 2 boards high using the mending plates to keep the boards aligned. Then I lined the new brooder box with an old plastic tarp, laid cardboard on top of the plastic, and covered it with pine shavings. I covered the top with a section of cattle panel and secured the brooder light to it. To retain heat at night, I added a tarp cover. After the birds were old enough to move outside, I easily disassembled the boards, hosed off the tarps, and returned the cattle panel to the garden, and didn't have a bulky brooder taking up space the rest of the year. And that was submitted by Renvy Smith of Rising Star, Texas. Well, I think we're just about out of time. You've been listening to another episode of Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy, and as always, thank you for listening.